From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
From War News Radio at Swarthmore College, I'm John Gagnon.
And I'm Will Sullivan.
This week on War News Radio, Facing the Unknown.
First, we present our editorial segment, Filibustered.
Next, we hear about leadership in Hong Kong's umbrella movement.
Then, we explore inconsistencies in the United States media's narrative of the Kurdish-U.S. partnership in the fight against the Islamic State from researchers and students. But first, a roundup of this week's news.
This Wednesday, two drivers drove their cars into a crowd of Israeli citizens in separate attacks. The first attack occurred in Jerusalem's center city when a Palestinian member of Hamas drove his car into a crowded train platform. One police officer was killed, and more than a dozen pedestrians were wounded. The second attack took place in the occupied West Bank. A large van with Palestinian plates hit three Israeli soldiers. The van fled the scene, and the search for the driver is still ongoing. These recent acts of violence have added fears that a third intifada, or uprising, is underway. The steep rise in tension and violence has been linked to two divisive disagreements between Israelis and Palestinians: which party should have control of East Jerusalem, and who may have access to the religious compound known to Jews as the Temple Mount or to Muslims as the Noble Sanctuary. In response to these recent attacks, Hamas leaders have responded, quote, "We believe it is a natural reaction to Israel's crimes."
Talks held this Wednesday in Burkina Faso failed to elect a civilian leader to head the country's transitional government. The landlocked West African nation is currently under military control, led by Lieutenant Colonel Isaac Zida, following the forced resignation of former President Blaise Compaoré. The presidents of nearby Ghana, Nigeria, and Senegal traveled to Burkina Faso to mediate Wednesday's talks and press for the swift, peaceful return to civilian rule. Following the talks, military and civilian leaders agreed to a one-year political transition with elections in November 2015. Lieutenant Colonel Zida pledged to hand power to a consensus government in line with the country's constitution and said that he intends to comply with the two-week deadline set by the African Union for him to do so.
While the number of new cases of Ebola in Liberia seems to be declining, the Liberian government continues to struggle to gain the nation's trust. An independent investigation concluded that a 15-year-old boy died from gunshot wounds inflicted by Liberian soldiers during a confrontation between civilians and soldiers in Liberia's capital this summer. The civilians were protesting an Ebola quarantine on their neighborhood. The Liberian army previously claimed that the soldiers were merely firing into the air during the confrontation. Furthermore, according to diplomats, supplies sent to Liberia to help combat the spread of the disease have been disappearing. Meanwhile, Ebola continues to spread in Sierra Leone as new data shows that the disease is spreading 9 times faster than it was a month ago. The remote district of Kanadugu is finding cases of the virus despite being under a self-imposed quarantine. With a lack of resources to treat Ebola in rural areas, the virus could continue to spread.
Islamic State militants killed over 300 members of the Al-Bunimir tribe in western Iraq last weekend, according to Iraqi government officials. The mass execution was reported to include women and children and was administered as punishment for resistance to the Islamic State's rule over the area. Under threat of similar treatment, only 15% of the tribal population in western Iraq opposes the Islamic State. Meanwhile, the battle over Kobani and Ain al-Adab continues as Kurdish Peshmerga forces and the Free Syrian Army have joined forces attempting to halt the Islamic State's incursion into the city. The battle over Kobani has taken on a symbolic nature in the larger conflict between coalition and Islamic State-led forces, distracting from large gains the Islamic State has made in other parts of Syria. The United States has continued its bombing campaign, hitting 14 sites in Syria and Iraq over the past few days, including the area surrounding Kobani and Ain al-Adab. Britain has promised to send more military trainers to Iraq to aid the Iraqi army. The outcome of the battle over Kobani and Ain al-Adab will likely have important consequences in terms of morale, as both sides have committed significant resources to the fight for the city.
The United Nations is expected to release a report to the International Atomic Energy Agency that Iran has not updated information about its nuclear program. The United States and 5 other countries, Russia, China, the United Kingdom, France, and Germany, are looking to create an agreement with Iran by November 24th about the future of its nuclear program. Iran has tentatively agreed to send its uranium to Russia, who had converted into specialized fuel rods, which are significantly harder to convert into nuclear weapons. However, nothing yet has been finalized. The six countries and Iran are meeting on November 18th to hopefully finalize an agreement.
Libya's Supreme Court ruled its parliament unconstitutional on Thursday. The decision came one day after gunmen stormed the country's biggest oil field and shut down production at the facility. The North African country is currently suffering from political chaos as two rival governments vie for control of the country. Libya has suffered turmoil ever since the overthrow of dictator Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. In the wake of the overthrow, Islamists launched Operation Dawn in order to displace the acting government from the capital, Tripoli, and set up their own parliament in its place. The internationally recognized government currently operates in the city Tobruk, while the Supreme Court remains based in the capital city, calling into question its ability to make judgments independent of Operation Dawn's influence. This development may hamper the ongoing efforts of the United Nations to mediate a reconciliation between the two.
Rebels in the northern Central African Republic are still using gold and diamonds to buy arms and fuel, a UN panel reported Wednesday. In spite of an embargo on the export of gems from Central African Republic, an estimated 140,000 carats of diamonds were smuggled out of the country last year. Taxes imposed on these exports by the Muslim Seleka rebel group fund their conflict with the country's Christian majority. The panel advised the UN peacekeeping force currently present in the Central African Republic to use drones and station troops to more closely monitor mining sites.
Police finally arrested José Luis Abarca, the fugitive mayor of Iguala, as well as his wife, on Tuesday. Iguala is a Mexican town where 43 students were abducted in September. Many hope that these arrests will help authorities find the missing students, who were traveling to a protest when the Iguala police intercepted and fired upon them, killing six and driving away with the remaining 43. Police have alleged that they were acting on Abarca's orders to prevent the students from interrupting an event held by the mayor's wife, and that the students were turned over to the Guerreros Unidos drug gang. Abarca and his wife have strong monetary and family ties to Guerreros Unidos. Mass graves with 28 bodies were discovered near Iguala, but initial tests did not suggest that the bodies were those of the students. Gang violence in Mexico has claimed over 100,000 lives since 2007.
On Tuesday, Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko removed special status for the eastern regions that are controlled by pro-Russian separatists and sent additional troops to cities near the Russo-Ukrainian border. The announcement coincided with elections organized by separatist leaders on Sunday. This occurred despite an agreement from both Russia and its separatist proxies when signing the ceasefire to honor the right for local elections to be held under Ukrainian law in early December. Germany and France, among other Western nations, criticized the violation of the ceasefire and asked Russia to not recognize the voting. NATO also reports that Russia has contributed to training rebel forces and has moved closer to the Ukrainian border.
Sometimes it's hard to listen to the news without getting angry. War News Radio's Sarah Morrell and Jay Clayton have stopped trying. War News Radio proudly presents Filibusted, an editorial segment for all the news that makes you want to tear your hair out.
Reporting live from our top-secret Ebola bunker deep in the heart of what is definitely not a college radio station.
Wait, Jay, don't tell them where we are. We only stockpiled 12 boxes of Lunchables.
Calling dibs on the mini pizzas.
We've got plenty of food and water to get us through this Ebola crisis, but I'm gonna need something stronger if I have to listen to any more panic.
Now that you mention it, why are we here? Last thing I remember was CNN telling me to go hide in a hole somewhere.
I was too distracted by Anderson Cooper's shiny hair to really listen to what he was saying.
Good thing we can still receive tweets, though, because on Halloween, MSN showed that Ebola isn't the real fear.
MSN tweeted a picture of a leaflet left under doorways near the Marine Corps base and the FBI Academy in Virginia. It had the Islamic State logo on it, and the Twitter sphere jumped to the conclusion that hashtag ISIS has infiltrated hashtag America.
Wow, as far as credibility goes, that's right up there with my uncle's sister's pet cat knows a guy who told me.
It gets better. The IS flag on the leaflet was upside down.
Now I'm getting flashbacks of all that news hype about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq.
Underneath the flag, we get the real message. In Arabic, you see the phrase, "We are here from Mexico and we came by train."
Luckily, US news networks and politicians are eminently responsible and would never spread a shocking claim like that without fact-checking it first.
The thing is, the makers of the pamphlet translated the sentence into Arabic wrong, so we can rest assured that this is fake. You know, in case you believed it beforehand.
Sorry, what was that? I was too busy founding the new filibustered-approved super PAC, Proud Americans for Our Terror-Free Border.
Well, we do know that the Islamic State spends a lot of time on those Mexican beaches.
You would too if you were working with the Mexican drug cartels.
Really, Jay? Where on earth do you hear such nonsense? Come on, we're talking about reliable sources, not conspiracy theories.
Well, actually, it was our newly elected senator from Arkansas, a proud member of the esteemed Grand Old White Guy Party, Tom Cotton. He told a town hall meeting that this deadly coalition of the Islamic State and drug cartels, quote, could infiltrate our defenseless border and attack us right here, in places like Arkansas. And don't worry, he made sure to reassure you that he'll be serious about this issue once he reaches the United States Senate.
And he's not the only one. Republican Representative Duncan Hunter from California wants to make sure you know that he's looking out for his citizens. He cares so much that he visited the Mexican-American border to find out about the threat from the Islamic State.
Wow. What did he discover on such an informative journey?
Well, he told Fox News that...
Did he know?
That officials from border security discussed with him a case of four Islamic State terrorists trying to cross the border. And shocker of all shockers, this wasn't true.
But let's not emerge from our bunker just yet. Scott Brown, one-time U.S. senator from Massachusetts, but fortunately not the incoming senator from New Hampshire, raised fears that these border-hopping terrorists may be infected with Ebola.
Wow, when was that? And did he already know he was going to lose?
Well, some people manage to win debates on this style of fear-mongering. Incoming Republican congressperson from Montana, Ryan Zink, one of many candidates calling for Obama to be impeached, ran rings around his opponent with comments about Ebola-infected IS agents coming in through Mexico.
Congressperson Zink, a former member of the legendary SEAL Team 6, is clearly worried about terrorists. But he also thinks the United States has lost track of the real enemy. Hillary Clinton.
He even goes as far as to call her the Antichrist.
That's absolutely ridiculous. The Antichrist wouldn't wear that many pantsuits.
Next thing we know, he's going to call for a Navy SEALs operation to take her down.
If the US military goes after the Antichrist, is that violating the separation of church and state?
Sadly, this deliberate panic is hardly unique. Between October 21st and 25th alone, there were 734 TV ads in states with competitive Senate races that referenced Ebola.
Now let's not get too hasty. Some of these ads merely played scary music while showing people in hazmat suits.
Subtle.
And these kinds of tactics aren't new. In the 2004 election, Bush administration officials met with Homeland Security Director Tom Ridge to get him to raise the terror alert every time the polls started to swing Democratic.
The administration denied this, of course, but in 2009, Tom Ridge admitted that he was pressured by former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and Attorney General John Ashcroft, saying that he often wondered, is this about security or politics?
And was that really effective?
Well, Bush's approval rating spiked each time the terror alert was raised. This was also the first time that large numbers of voters gave terrorism as the main reason they voted for a presidential candidate.
I'm way more concerned about Hillary Clinton, Antichrist.
No, I'm pretty sure that's the next Avengers film.
I hear she teams up with Abraham Lincoln to hunt vampires.
But there's actually research that suggests people do vote Republican when they're scared. When people are primed with images of death, they act conservative. And that's a pretty broad category. Psychologists made people more conservative by showing them clips from Stephen King's It.
You know, I'd be fearing for my life too if a creepy dancing clown turned into a giant killer spider right before my eyes.
Maybe they're afraid Mitch McConnell is secretly a giant killer turtle.
Come down to the Senate chamber, Georgie. They all float down here.
Thing is, when this type of fear-mongering becomes a mainstream narrative, even supposedly moderate politicians feel that they can win big at the polls by stoking voter panic.
My favorite dynamic duo of Governors Christie and Cuomo have their own opinions about how we can stop the spread of Ebola.
Wow, it's like Batman and Robin, except their super secret power is being really wealthy.
Wait, that is Batman.
Look, I know the Nolan films were pretty dark, but I don't remember Christian Bale's Batman ever trying to forcibly quarantine someone just for helping the sick.
Casey Hickox, a nurse who had just returned to the United States after helping Ebola patients in Sierra Leone, was quarantined by New York and New Jersey officials because a forehead scan at the airport showed she had a mild fever.
The Center for Disease Control examined her and found that she had no symptoms of Ebola whatsoever. But because of the procedures implemented by Governors Cuomo and Christie, she was told that she had to be quarantined for 21 days.
She was quarantined, by the way, in a tiny little tent without adequate heating, just a portable toilet and no shower or TV.
After pressure from the Obama administration, first Cuomo and then Christie relaxed the quarantine requirements and did let Casey Hickox return home.
But Christie couldn't let a challenge to his authority like that go without comment. Oh no. In fact, he's doubled down on his decision. He said that Hickox was obviously ill, despite the lack of any symptoms of illness, and compared her outrage at the quarantine conditions to an angry traveler waiting for a delayed plane.
I know we're usually pretty dismissive of politicians who think their first priority is hugging people on the campaign trail, but if the alternative is Christie playing doctor, I'll take Obama hugging former Ebola patient Nina Pham any day.
So if Christie famously hugged Obama, and Obama hugged Pham, does that mean Christie has Ebola?
Christie was the kid on the playground who was always scared of catching cooties, wasn't he?
Maybe Christie and Cuomo do really think Ebola is scary enough to justify such extreme behavior. But if their real goal was to stop the spread of the disease, they'd be encouraging American MDs to work with Doctors Without Borders, not quarantining them.
But there is a presidential election in a few years, and so long as there's someone in Iowa or New Hampshire who thinks that their neighbor might sneeze on them wrong, politicians with their eyes on the White House will make decisions based on pathological fears rather than good policy.
Ebola is scary. The Islamic State is scary. We should be doing something about them. But all these senators and congresspeople and governors who warn us about Ebola-infected nurses and terrorists working with drug cartels aren't helping. They're just trying to get an early start for their next campaign.
They want us in our bunker with our mini pizza Lunchables and our tequila. They want us there because in that bunker, TSA regulations and NSA spying and unlimited drone warfare seem so much more reasonable than they do when we're thinking clearly.
The only way to combat this atmosphere of fear is to just give up and laugh. Laugh at them and their fear-mongering, because then we can focus on real solutions.
Well, at least we have the laughing part down. For Filibusted, I'm Jay Clayton.
And I'm Sarah Morrell. It's been a pleasure, at least for us.
Hong Kong's umbrella movement has recently passed its one-month anniversary, and protesters are still occupying major roads in the city. While the movement was initiated by Benny Tai, a professor from the University of Hong Kong, college students have become more prominent representatives of the protesters' demands, particularly after their meeting with high-level government officials. Catherine Kwok and Natasha Chok report on the questions emerging around the movement's leadership as the need for concrete results looms large.
Over a month has passed since Hong Kong citizens and students began occupying major arteries of the city's business districts in search of democracy. The occupied areas have become what locals described as small cities. People have set up study zones complete with desk lamps, even medical tents and rest stops with couches. While the civil disobedience movement was initiated by Occupy Central, a political group led by Benny Tai, an associate professor of law at the University of Hong Kong, college students have gradually emerged as the protest's main representatives.
On October 21st, five executive members of the College Student Union, Hong Kong Federation of Students, met with Hong Kong Chief Secretary Carrie Lam Cheng Yun Ngo for the first time since the protest started. Both groups stood their ground. Lam said electoral reform should follow the procedures Beijing provided on August 31st, although there may be room for change in the future. And the HKFS placed three demands on the table. First, a revised proposal from the Standing Committee of the People's National Congress. Second, use of civic nomination in the chief executive elections. And third, the abolishment of the functional constituency.
While the students presented demands that run parallel to the protest's general call for democracy, it is not clear whether a majority of protesters agree with the students' conditions. The Hong Kong Federation of Students, Scholarism, a secondary school student political group, and the Occupy Central leaders have recently shelved a poll that was supposed to be held on October 26 to garner protesters' general opinions. The student and pan-democrat activist said the differences among the protesters with regards to the poll's content and effectiveness contributed to the sudden halt. The poll included two motions, one to abolish the clause about the election committee in Beijing's August proposal, and another to remove the functional constituency from legislative council elections. In light of the incident, some protesters have expressed concerns over the student leaders' inability to integrate the masses' opinions into their demands, and even question the students' general control over the movement.
The mass, they are not willing to listen to them, to the command of the student leaders. Therefore, I think that in this current situation, the student leaders actually can do nothing to motivate all the protesters, because I think in this campaign, the leaders now are very passive. They are very subject to the decision of the protesters. For example, in the proposed referendum on the last Sunday is cancelled because from the strong opposition from the public. Therefore, I think that they cannot lead this campaign in this situation.
You just heard Coleman Lee, a college student majoring in government and law at the University of Hong Kong. Many who were part of the Occupy movement from the very beginning fear that the movement has become static compared to the momentum it gained earlier on. In particular, Nora Lam, a sophomore at the University of Hong Kong, feels that the Occupy movement will end soon without any concrete changes in the current system as people begin to realize the futility of their occupation. Students, like Coleman, worry that public opinion may shift against their favor, leading to greater disunity within society.
The student leaders have provided, to myself, I think they provide great leadership in leading this so-called umbrella movement. And right at the beginning, they have very firm position regarding the political development for Hong Kong, and they challenge the authority. Step by step.
That was Pan Democratic legislator Albert Chan. Chan also said that sit-ins should continue as long as they do not escalate to violence. In order to move ahead, he suggests the student leaders to approach Pan Democratic legislators and promote a de facto referendum. Chan was involved in a de facto referendum in 2010, where five legislators resigned from five different geographical constituencies, triggering a by-election where all Hong Kong citizens of age could vote. When looking for possible candidates for the umbrella movement's leadership, some questioned the involvement or lack thereof of pan-democratic legislators. Particularly, why are legislators not as involved in the movement as student leaders are?
I don't believe the legislator can create similar leadership compared to the students, because the legislative councillor and also many of the pan-democrat political party leaders, they are too pragmatic. They never has such courage and dedication and passion that the students have. So I don't think the old guards can take such lead. So I urge all those old guards, step aside and let the young students take the leadership. What the students have done in the past year have done far much more than the pan-democrats have done in the past 30 years.
On Sunday night, the two leading student groups, Hong Kong Federation of Students and Scholarism, met with numerous pan-democratic legislators in hopes of organizing a de facto election. However, Labour Party Chairman Lee Chek-yen says they have not yet reached a consensus, as some of them have reservations with the current pan-democratic legislators' abilities to win the elections. If unsuccessful, they would lose their seats in the Legislative Council and fail to stop Beijing's electoral reform proposal from passing.
In order to sustain a campaign, certain decisions have to be made. For example, how long are we going to sustain the occupation? And if the government does not respond positively to the campaign, what else should be done? These sort of decisions should be made collectively, and therefore I think as legislators, we have the responsibilities to begin to get the campaign a bit more organized. And of course, I think the next step would be for the students and other political leaders to come together and get the campaign more organized, improve the support for all three occupied districts, and get ready to negotiate with either the SAR government, or I think the students are pointing to directly talk to the central government officials.
You just heard from Fernando Zheng Chiu-Hong, a legislator from the Labour Party. While Zheng believes there is no clear leadership that can control the protesters, given the self-initiated nature of the movement, he applauds the student leaders for clearly asserting and defending their demands during the talks with government officials earlier on October 21st.
Pan-democratic legislators continue to express discontent with Chief Executive Leung Chun-ying's government within the Legislative Council. All 23 pan-democrats announced on Tuesday, November 4th, that they will boycott meetings with Leung and his administrations with regards to the budget for the next fiscal year, since Leung refused to meet them as a group earlier on. In contrast to the pan-democrats, some conservative legislators believe that there should be absolutely no collaboration between lawmakers and protesters.
This movement has caused a lot of economic hardship to people across social strata. Moreover, it is undermining the rule of law because injunctions are not being enforced. I think legislators being lawmakers should not support people who are breaking the law.
In particular, chairperson of New People's Party, pro-establishment legislator Regina Ip Lau believes that students are merely worsening the situation by demanding the impossible. Although the pro-establishments have expressed strong objection against the movement from the very beginning, James Tian of the Liberal Party recently spoke against the government, suggesting that Chief Executive Lern Chen-ying should consider resigning, given the public outrage on his leadership. This is the first time a pro-establishment legislator has voiced against the government, and as a result, he was expelled from the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference, China's top advisory body.
The Hong Kong Federation of Students announced on Tuesday that five members will travel to Beijing on Friday in time for the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Conference to demand dialogue with Chinese officials. While this may bring some progress to the movement, some legislators worry that students would be detained in the mainland.
Heading into the sixth week of the umbrella movement, concerns over representing protesters' demands and questions of whether the sit-ins should continue underscore the movement's lack of organization and leadership. As dialogue between the Hong Kong government and protest representatives continue, the question of leadership will remain an important issue. Thanks again to Nora from the University of Hong Kong's Campus TV for helping with the interviews. For War News Radio, I'm Natasha Chak.
And I'm Catherine Kwok.
As the Islamic State pursues its campaign for territorial expansion, the majority of the opposition has come not from the Iraqi central government, but from the Peshmergas, Kurdish military forces in Syria and Iraq. With the current struggle between Kurdish forces and the Islamic State for the Syrian city of Kobani, Western media outlets now focus on the Kurds as the pivotal force opposing the Islamic State. But, despite the important role that Kurdish forces played in the Iraq War, American media still doesn't connect these efforts to their long history of fighting for independence. In the following piece, Leo Elliott looks at inconsistencies in the U.S. media's narrative of the Kurdish-U.S. partnership.
The Kurds are an ethnic group in the Middle East with a shared language, culture, and history. Kurdish-populated lands, known collectively as Kurdistan, span an area that includes parts of northern Iraq, western Iran, northeastern Syria, and southeastern Turkey. As the story is being told, the current weakness of Baghdad, stronger economic ties with Turkey, and the threat of ISIS have paved the way for a strong partnership between the Kurds, the West, and Turkey. Indeed, the Kurds are depicted as not only secular and democratic, but also specifically pro-Western. But this narrative neglects the tensions that exist between Turkey, the U.S., and Kurdish political bodies over the coming question of Kurdish statehood. It also obscures differences between the various Kurdish political organizations themselves. By confronting the threat of ISIS, the Kurds of Iraq and Syria have come to the forefront of American policy in the region. But the real story of the Kurds is more complex than the one being told by the Western media. Relations between the KRG, which is the regional government of Iraqi Kurdistan, and the U.S. have indeed strengthened over the last decade. We sat down with Dr. Mohammed Sharif, a fellow at the London Institute for Asiatics, to discuss the ways in which this relationship has developed.
In 2007, the KRG representation to Washington was officially opened. You have an official embassy, if you like, or a representation of the Kurdistan region in Washington, D.C., in 2008, following that, in 2008, you had the establishment of the Kurdish-American Congressional Caucus, which has around 53 congressional members. And then following that, in 2011, you had the opening of the U.S. consulate in Erbil. That's on the political level. Then on the economic level, in 2012, you had the establishment of the United States Kurdistan Business Council.
Dr. Sharif went on to discuss a similar strengthening of the relationship between Turkey and the KRG.
With regards to Turkey, I don't see these developments as superficial at all, because last year alone, in 2013, trade exchange between the Kurdistan region alone and the Republic of Turkey was $8 billion. $8 billion is a substantial sum, which accounts for more than 75% of total trade exchange between Turkey and Iraq.
Shifts in the strategic analyses of Turkey and the U.S. have also led to stronger diplomatic relations with the KRG. We spoke to Dr. Soner Çağatay, director of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute for Middle East Studies, who argues that as Turkey has watched moderate Islamist governments fail across the region, it has begun channeling its secular side and seeks a stronger relationship with the KRG.
I think this is basically recognizing that Turkey's Middle East policy has not made Turkey a Middle East power, that Turkey has little influence in regional capitals, whether it's Damascus or Baghdad, that Turkey's ambitions to dominate or change Iraqi and Syrian politics have been bookended by another regional competitor, Iran, that Turkey's policy of supporting the Muslim Brotherhood-related parties in Egypt and Syria and Tunisia and Libya have largely failed.
Dr. Çağatay explains that these failures have encouraged Turkey to befriend the KRG.
So Turkey's left with no friends and no allies and no proxies in the Middle East. And the Kurds have become Turkey's only proxy in the region, only friend and ally, both in terms of regional politics, but also as a very necessary cordon sanitaire, sort of a buffer zone that would shield Turkey from sectarian war, al-Qaeda presence, ISIS threats, and all sorts of instability coming from Iraq and Syria.
Cooperation between the U.S., Turkey, and the Kurds is more complex, however, when all Kurds in the region are considered. Turkey has been engaged in an ongoing conflict with the PKK, a Kurdish nationalist militia in Turkey, since 1984. A 2013 truce between Turkey and the PKK recently ended over tensions regarding Turkey's reluctance to let Peshmerga forces cross its border to fight ISIS in Syria. Turkey has been far less willing to cooperate with PYD, the major Kurdish political organization in Syria, than the KRG, Iraqi Kurdistan's regional government, because the PYD has a closer relationship with the PKK. The PKK and the PYD share a historical grounding in socialist, anti-imperialist, and left-wing ideology. This reality complicates the representation of the Kurds in the U.S. media as uniformly pro-United States and pro-West, simply because they are democratic. We had the opportunity to speak with a Kurdish student and journalist named Yadgar Ismail, who recently graduated with an MA from Brunel University in London and now lives in Erbil, the capital of Iraqi Kurdistan, on this topic.
Even the Kurdish community is somehow divided. We can say it is divided, even though the pro-Turkey, pro-KRG, pro-West are more. But there are still some supporters of Iran being involved in fighting ISIS, something that U.S. may not like. U.S. doesn't like Iran to, let's say, to be in this alliance that is now fighting IS. So it's a very complicated issue. You have two different political equations that contradict each other. You have Iran, you have Turkey, you have Iraq, you have Turkey, you have Iraq, you have KRG. Then you have PDK, let's say, the party of the KRG president, which is not in a good relation with PKK and PYD. So it's very complicated.
We also spoke to another Kurdish student named Hamad Jamal Ali, who lives in Suleymaniye, a city in Iraqi Kurdistan. He expressed a view that the diversity of voices in Kurdish areas varies not only from political group to political group, but from city to city.
If you talk about Kurdistan, you can't really talk about it in general because there are differences between each area. Like, each city has different people, each city has different beliefs. For example, I live in Suleiman City, and it's a very liberal city, whereas if you go to the south, like Duhok, it's like more religiously conservative.
The Kurds have distinct desires and strategic goals, but treating the Kurds as an inherently pro-West people leaves these real Kurdish goals out of the conversation. Yadgar weighed in on this issue, saying that many in Iraqi Kurdistan see the conflict as a means to gain power and establish independence.
There are two different opinions about this in the Kurdish community here. The first opinion is that fighting ISIS is actually an opportunity to go for independence in quicker than it was expected. But then the other opinion, let's say the other side of the argument says that perhaps ISIS actually stopped independence that KRG was going for a few months ago. I mean, the president of KRG actually declared that the working with Iraqi central government has been failure, and it's time for the Kurdish people to decide for themselves whether they want to actually go for independence or stay with Iraq.
But whether the independence movement of the KRG is hindered or helped by the conflict with ISIS, Yadgar expressed no doubt that a declaration of independence would come soon.
The thing is now we have to deal with ISIS, then I think it's just a matter of time. Maybe in next year we will vote, there will be a referendum.
Hama expressed a similar sentiment. The unifying feature, in Hama's view, of the various Kurdish regions is a desire for self-rule.
to be honest with you, like, the ultimate goal of the majority of the Kurdish population is an independent Kurdish state. I don't really think that like uniting the four parts of Kurdistan is going to happen in the near future. But most of the Kurdish people have that at the back of their mind, that one day all the different parts of Kurdistan are going to be united in their united government and ruled by Kurdish people.
But the Kurdish ambitions for independence, or at least autonomy, are no secret. As Yadgar noted, the KRG president Masoud Barzani has stated that the KRG intends to move further away from Baghdad supervision and towards independence. During our conversation, Dr. Mohammed Sharif noted the clarity of the Kurds' intentions.
I mean, if you go back to the referendum of January 2005, it was an informal referendum on the independence of Kurdistan. 98.8% of Kurdish people informally participated and voted for Kurdish independence. So I'm assuming this message has been received in Washington. They appreciate that this is what the Kurdish people desire.
U.S. policymakers should be completely aware of the fact that self-rule is a priority of Kurdish political organizations, but the Western media is not talking about it. This contradiction helps to explain a theme that showed up in almost all of our interviews, the substantial inadequacy of U.S. support for the Kurds. The Kurds have the sheer manpower to match ISIS, but they don't have the resources to manage a humanitarian crisis and a war. Despite the U.S. narrative of a strong U.S.-Kurdish relationship, the U.S. commitment to a one-Iraq policy of a united democratic Iraq may limit the amount of support the U.S. is actually willing to extend to the Kurds. Yadgar pointed out the hypocrisy of a U.S. policy that supplies heavy arms to an unstable central Iraq, but contributes weaker munitions to the KRG.
Yeah, there's a, let's say, strong debate, a long debate every day, on the streets, on the TVs here, international televisions and networks, about whether what the U.S. is doing is enough or is I think it's not enough, because as you may know now, the airstrikes may actually, they have changed a little bit of the, let's say, the situation, but I don't think they are enough. More weapons are needed, you know, modern weapons. Let's not forget that the ISIS are using U.S.-made weapons and NATO-made weapons, Humvees and Hammers that are bulletproof, and Peshmerga were actually, you know, suffering, you know, fighting them. They couldn't actually resist. So I think there is need for more weapons, more sophisticated weapons, U.S.-made weapons to use against U.S.-made weapons.
Hama focused on the humanitarian crisis, where the massive refugee outflows from the Syrian conflict have only grown as ISIS has become more powerful.
I don't think the resources are enough. For example, the refugees, some of the refugees are in school, and some of the schools haven't started the year, like they have missed a semester because of the refugee crisis. You know, as winter approaches, there are going to be other problems. I think we are really in need of international support for the refugee crisis that is currently taking place in Kurdistan.
And Dr. Mohammed Sharid captured the way in which these gaps in U.S. support heighten budget constraints of the KRG.
The Kurds haven't been receiving funding from Baghdad since February this year. People are getting quite desperate. The government in Baghdad has been pursuing a pro-Shiite, sectarian and divisive policy. So people are struggling, as well as the government. So obviously what can be done is more American support in terms of financial support for the United Nations. Especially, I'm aware that the UNHCR is playing a major role at the moment with more funding. That would be an excellent thing. And secondly, the United States is already striking the Islamic State. But I think the major problem really with the Kurds, and they've been complaining about it for a while, I mean, the weapons they're receiving from the United States are not heavy armor. It's not heavy weaponry. They're quite old Russian-made light weaponry.
Dr. Mohammed Sharid provided one explanation for U.S. reluctance to provide the Kurds with heavy weaponry.
With air attacks, you have a limited success rate. After that, you have to retake control of that territory. And you can't really retake control of territory with AK-47s and light weaponry. So that is a major flaw on the American side. And it seems that the Americans are reluctant to provide heavy weaponry to the Kurds because they feel that may be used potentially for the future declaration of Kurdistan's independence.
If support for the Kurds has been inadequate, this inadequacy is at least partially related to Western and Turkish fears of Kurdish aspirations. We have to ask whether the U.S. government is acting to empower the Kurds or to use the Kurds as a delay tactic. If the U.S. decides to put its full weight behind the Iraqi Kurdish Peshmergas, it must accept that the defeat of ISIS will ask as many questions as it will answer. If the KRG establishes independence, what would be the status of Kurds in Syria and Arabs in Iraqi Kurdistan? What would happen to people and cities in the contested regions of Iraq that are historically Kurdish but have been populated with Arab people over the past decades? Could the relationship between Turkey and an independent Kurdistan ever be viable? Would an independent Kurdistan stabilize or destabilize Iraq? As much as the U.S. wants to avoid confronting these issues, the Kurds are strong in their own right. The KRG will continue to push for Kurdish self-rule, and the questions that follow cannot be ducked forever.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archived shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Mayank Agrawal, Rachel Diamond, Amelia Erskine, Evan Grennan, Catherine Kwok, Zoe Rain, Rachel Sasella, and Tyler Welsh. Our piece editors are Amy DePiro, Allison Habar, Sabrina Merrill, and Sarah Morrell. This week's show is produced by Sabrina Merrill and Allison Habar. I'm Will Sullivan.
And I'm John Gagnon. Until next time, thanks for listening.